This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
A very good day to you. Glad to have you with us on Trumpet Hour. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're going to start today's program with a dramatic story out of Hungary, where free speech and freedom of the press are under assault. The country's prime minister is turning the country's media into a government monopoly and a propaganda machine. It's a trend that Americans can increasingly identify. Trumpet writer Mihailo Zekic has interviewed the leading journalist of a newspaper in Hungary that was recently shut down, part of a government crackdown on what it considers dissident media. This man is now the managing editor of Hungary's second largest independent weekly, and he talks about the pressure the government is putting on him and his fellow journalists. Mr. Zekic will bring us a report based on his interview. Then the royal family of Britain has gone through a very rough last few years. The Trumpet has been following the royals for decades because of the remarkable truth that they are descended from the royal line of King David in the Bible. If you've never proven this to yourself, this might sound far-fetched, but it's true. The British crown fulfills a promise God made to David that his royal lineage would continue right up until the second coming of Jesus Christ. But something dramatically changed 4 years ago, January of 2017. God actually moved that royal line away from Britain, and we've seen a dramatic decline in the royal family ever since. We're going to hear a report from Trumpet writer Richard Palmer from our office in England, looking at the most recent developments in the split between the royal family and the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, Harry and his wife Meghan. In our third segment, we'll go to Germany, where a hit television show looks back at the Weimar Republic of Germany between World Wars I and II. The title of the program is Babylon, Berlin. It's an allusion to the biblical city of Babylon, well known for its corruption and immorality, but it actually also points to the literal roots of modern Germany and some biblical prophecy about Germany as well. We'll learn about this in a report from our native German on the Trumpet staff, Josue Michels. And then we'll finish the program with a last word about taking responsibility and grabbing the reins of your own life. But over now to Hungary, where the free press is under attack, as we will now hear in this report from Mihailo Zekic.
Eastern Europe has had one of the most turbulent recent histories of any region in the world. The Nazis and their local fascist allies disfigured the region heavily during World War II. After the war, the Soviets installed puppet communist regimes that ruled with an iron fist for decades. Among other atrocities committed during these periods, political enemies were persecuted and access to information was tightly controlled. The media was little more than government propaganda, and dissenting voices were punished. Change began in 1989. One by one, the communist regimes were toppled, and free market democracy replaced them. On the coattails of that was the introduction of liberties like freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom of association. Hungary was one of those Eastern European countries to gain freedom in the late 80s and early 90s. 30 years on, and Hungary is turning into a dictatorship again. And basic freedoms, like freedom of the press, are being eroded away. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban and his Fidesz party, in power since 2010, have been getting news company after news company either under their control or under the control of government-friendly oligarchs. To date, there is only one national television channel and national daily newspaper in Hungary independent of the government, and the last independent radio station in the country was forced off the air earlier this month. The media outlets that refuse to get under Orbán's thumb are persecuted. The Trumpet interviewed Csaba Lukák, managing editor of Magyar Hang, or Hungarian Voice, which is the second largest weekly newspaper in the country. He's seen the government's persecution against independent media firsthand. He remembers well when Netsabatshag, what used to be the largest left-wing paper in the country, mysteriously closed down several years ago. Netsabatshag claimed that it was due to financial problems, but Lukoc is certain that it was due to behind-the-scenes meddling by Fidesz. Next to fall was the biggest conservative paper, Magyar Nemzet, which Lukoc worked for as a leading journalist. 2018 was the year of the Hungarian parliamentary elections, which Fidesz won. Clip 1.
And then there were the elections. And after the next day after the election, we get an email from editor-in-chief that we have to be on the office next day. And he convoked a meeting. And in that meeting, he said that that will be the very last edition of Magyar Nemzet, which was the biggest conservative daily newspaper at that time.
Over 100 journalists were fired. Not willing to give up without a fight, Lukoc and a few other journalists from Magyar Nemzet developed what he called a Samizdat paper, referring to dissident underground papers published during the communist period. This paper is Magyar Hang, but Magyar Hang still has immense pressure from the government, especially in the areas of financing. Clip 2.
We could not get any advertising. In Hungarian advertising market, the government has an extremely big role, unfortunately. So like 70% of all marketing's budget, it's made by governmental-owned companies. And they didn't spend any penny at Magyar Hang. And also the private companies who are from business, they are not brave enough to try what will happen if they will spend some money on us. So I am not 100% sure that they will be punished, but they doesn't want to try it.
The lack of advertising revenue forces Magyar Hang to rely almost exclusively on sales to keep itself afloat. The customers have been very loyal to the paper. It has grown to become the second biggest weekly in the country, despite the pressure from Fidesz. Lukoc estimates that Magyar Hang would have an even bigger following, but the public knows that the government has it in for Magyar Hang. Magyar Hang gets inquiries from potential customers all the time about the political repercussions of subscribing to the paper. People are afraid that having their name on the subscription list would put them on the government's radar. Clip 3.
The people are not sure that they will be punished or not if they become our subscribers. So we are receiving thousands of questions from countryside people that, okay, I would subscribe to your newspaper, but the local mayor or the local Fidesz leader or the local government person would know that I am subscribing. And we could not say for them for sure that they will not know.
And the public's fears are well-founded. It isn't just the paper itself that the government attacks. Individual journalists, their families, and the subscribers are all victims of government harassment. Lukoc continues. Clip 5.
If you are a journalist of Magyar Hang and your wife is working in a government organization and they realize that your wife is working there, she will be probably fired. If you are applying for, you know, any grants or any kind of support which is related by the government, you will not receive it. If you are a subscriber, if you are living in a small village and you are a subscriber of Hungarian Voice and the mayor knows that, you probably will be not get that kind of services which is common for the other one. So if you need some, you know, help from the local authorities, they will say no. So you have to be part of you have to be voter of the Fidesz and part of the government party to be considered as a 100% human person. If you are not with them, they will try to put obstacle in your life. in every way when they can.
All of this persecution is surprising, considering Majorhang's conservative standpoint. Viktor Orban and Fidesz run on a conservative platform. Magyar Nemzet was owned by a former oligarch friend of Orban's. They had a split 5 years before the paper closed, and Lukács described that five-year period as the freest he ever had as a journalist. But it's not Majorhang's conservatism that's the problem, but the paper's opposition to the government. The paper is often branded as a puppet of influential Hungarian-American financier George Soros. Clip 4.
And of course, we are called every time when it's possible. The Soros army, the fake news guy, or I don't know, the left-handed and liberal enemy of the country. So we have all kind of, you know, stigmas on us, which is of course not true. We are considering ourselves as a conservative but critical newspaper with the government, but they are not accepting that we are conservative. You could not be conservative if you are not supporting Fidesz. So if you are not supporting the great leader of Orban, you are paid by Soros and you are a liberal enemy of the country.
This is all in Hungary, a member state of the European Union and NATO. It is, on paper, a liberal democracy. But Budapest is turning more and more illiberal. And this is especially troubling when considering Hungary's recent past. During World War II, Hungary was first ruled by the pro-Hitler dictator Miklos Horthy, who participated in Germany's Eastern Front campaign. He was later replaced by Hungary's rabidly anti-Semitic fascist party, the Arrow Cross, which sent Hungary's Jewish population to the death camps. After the war, Hungary was ruled by a Soviet-sponsored communist government for decades. Is Viktor Orban's regime turning into a new 21st-century Hungarian dictatorship? We asked Lukács if he thought Fidesz's suppression of the media could follow the path of the fascists and communists. Clip 6.
Yeah, they are trying to reach them. So a couple of years ago, they had 20% of media. Now they control 80%. And they are aiming for 100%, I'm sure. So they will never stop it. So they want to have a totally control.
All of this is even more startling when you consider that the EU is doing very little about Hungary's path to dictatorship. They've issued angry statements and implemented token punishments here and there, but very little to actually cause Orban to reverse course. What does this mean for Europe? The Bible has a lot to say about the growing authoritarianism in Europe, including what is happening in Hungary right now. Daniel 7 and Revelation 13 mention a beast, a biblical symbol of an empire that devours the whole earth, according to Daniel 7 verse 20, according to Daniel 7 verse 23. This is referring to a European superpower emerging from the ashes of the world-ruling Roman Empire. The biblical accounts show that this empire has unmatchable warrior prowess and a dangerous police state apparatus that goes after those who disagree with its policies. It has a propaganda machine that causes people to worship it. And a related prophecy in Revelation 17 shows that this empire will be made up of a conglomeration of 10 European nations that will be on the scene just before the return of Christ, the time we are living in today. This means that Europe is going to take a very dictatorial turn in the very near future. And what is happening in Hungary has everything to do with it. In his July 2020 article, Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote that, quote, Orban's power grab may affect the whole continent, unquote, referring to a state of emergency Hungary enacted last year that essentially legalized Orban's dictatorship. Mr. Fleury continues, quote, the EU did not act to punish Orban. It did nothing. Is the acceptance of Orbán's dictatorship in the EU a sign that the time has come for Europe's 10 kings to emerge? It is almost certain that Hungary will be a part of the coming 10-nation European superpower. Unquote. Watch Hungary, and watch Europe as a whole. Hungary's slide to dictatorship is just the opening act of a transformation of the entire continent into an empire. And when the transformation is complete, it will rock the world. To learn more, please read Mr. Fleury's article, Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire, at thetrumpet.com.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The royal family of Britain is going through a very public, very messy divorce with the royal formerly known as Prince Harry. We'll learn why and why this is more important than most people realize in this report from Richard Palmer.
Last week, we saw the final break between the royal family and the Duke and the Duchess of Sussex. That's Harry and his wife, Meghan. This time last year, Harry and Meghan were mostly rejected as working members of the royal family, but some of their ties remain. The Queen was apparently hopeful that that Prince Harry would change his mind, and she wanted to leave some kind of a road back for him. These last remaining ties were cut at the end of the last week. All hope that this division could easily be healed is now gone, and the royal family stands on the brink of what could be an even more destructive public fight. What's been going on? When Harry and Meghan quit the royal family, there was a one-year transition arrangement. They wanted to keep some ties. Like I said, the Queen wanted to have a bridge back. This year was coming to an end, that one-year time period, and so the two sides were negotiating on what things would look like in more of the long term. At the same time, though, Harry and Meghan were in talks with someone else. They were preparing to do a TV interview with Oprah. They knew that the Queen would not at all be pleased with this kind of thing. The royal family looks at that as publicity-seeking, as a kind of celebrityism. As the Daily Mail wrote to the royals and their advisors, TV confessionals of this kind provided over by Miss Winfrey are not compatible with royal life and the privileges that go with it. They also wrote the date of March 7th when Harry and Meghan genuflect before TV Queen Oprah is likely to be engraved in the royal memory, just like Diana's panorama appearance on November 20th, 1995. The very real concern is that it will reopen other wounds, such as the rift between Harry and his brother and between their wives. So the royal family is dead against this kind of gossipy, inside scoop type TV show. They're very worried that it would descend quickly into public accusations against other members of the royal family. And so the Duke and Duchess of Sussex worked to keep the Oprah interview secret while they worked on a divorce deal from the royal family. And so they hoped they could get a more amicable split. And then only afterwards announced this Oprah TV appearance when it was all done and dusted and too late for the Queen to do anything about it. But something went wrong with their schedule. Someone on Oprah's production team accidentally let the news of the interview leak out. The royal family heard about it, and the Queen was not happy. Richard Kay reports in the Daily Mail that it was not just that so much promise was unfulfilled, but that all the affection and indulgence shown to Harry had been so spectacularly ignored or even thrown back in her face. So instead of the two sides working together on some kind of divorce deal, on Friday, Buckingham Palace responded and put out a statement. They wrote, "The Queen has written confirming that in stepping away from the work of the royal family, it is not possible to continue with the responsibilities and duties that come with a life of public service. The honorary military appointments and royal patronages held by the Duke and Duchess will therefore be returned to Her Majesty before being redistributed among working members of the royal family." And the Sussexes were not at all happy with this. They sent out their own reply very quickly, saying that they would live a life of service outside the royal family, saying that we can all live a life of service. Service is universal. The Daily Mail reported that although officials do not want a slanging match, many are said to feel the barbed statement was horribly disrespectful to the elderly monarch, whose husband Philip is in hospital. They quoted another anonymous source saying the peevish disrespect Harry and Meghan showed the Queen yesterday, in a statement which they appeared to lecture on the meaning of duty and service, sent shockwaves through the palace and beyond. Another anonymous palace insider said it was unconscionable of the couple to have had the last word. It showed such disrespect. And another palace insider. This one said, let's be clear, the Sussexes instigated this. They jumped, but the Queen is firm. Either you're a public servant or you aren't. You can't line your own pockets while undertaking official duties. And another official said she made it abundantly clear to her grandson that you're either in or you're out when it comes to being a member of the royal family or working royal. She said, you work for the monarchy. The monarchy doesn't work for you. So the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, they want to have their own charity events. They want to decide what they spend their money on, what appearances they go to, what causes they support, all without any reference or oversight to the rest of the royal family. They want to be able to do what they want without that coordination. And they want to be free to make money on the side, to sign deals with Netflix and Spotify. And then there's even other marketing things that they've been getting involved in. They want to be free to profit as well. So the split means they will be forced to give up a lot of their high-profile roles that they still had, especially Prince Harry's three honorary military positions. They also have had to give up their roles with the Queen's Commonwealth Trust. So they're giving up some of these last remaining positions. So Harry and Meghan, they say they want to serve, but they want to do it their own way. They want to do it outside of what this throne has set up. And they want to be able to make money and profit personally while doing it. Now, we've been watching the royal family and this fallout closely. In the September 2017 Trumpet print magazine, editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote an article called The Fall of the British Royal Family. In that article, he wrote, "What is wrong with Britain and the royal family? This issue is far more important than people generally realize." That article lamented the decline of the royal family. It talked about the troubled lives that many of the royals have had recently. It talked about the way the family and the country have drifted from biblical morality, and that many of the young royals, especially Prince Harry, have gotten behind causes that are really anti-Bible. You've seen Meghan and Harry, even much more recently than that article, become more and more involved in US politics. You had the two of them putting out a video last November very strongly hinting that people should go and vote Democrat. It's since been revealed that the Duchess Meghan had a meeting with the Democratic governor of California, Gavin Newsom. And since Mr. Flurry wrote that, look at the turmoil the royal family has gone through as well. That was back in 2017. And that turmoil could get much worse in the next few weeks, with this split becoming more acrimonious and more public. And these two, they've gotten fully on board with the kind of leftist woke agenda. They're doing a lot of talk about racism and about how racist Britain and America are. And they've joined this attack on British and American history. The two of them are very close to the Obamas, with Meghan appearing beside Michelle Obama at a key event over the summer. So the fact that the royal family has been hit by a series of crises, and then just this massive divorce deal, the biggest thing to happen to the royal family in decades, to be hit by this just after Mr. Flurry published an article about the rapid decline, forecasting that the royal family would go into a rapid decline, that should cause us to want to look more deeply into what is happening here. Because this is a throne that once brought unity, now only bringing division. We can see a clear difference, a clear change in this throne. And that is underpinned by an important spiritual reality. God has a plan for a royal family that brings blessings, not curses, to those that he rules. A royal family done God's way that brings unity. Mr. Flurry explained this in a Key of David episode back in 2018. The title was The New Throne of David. And he wrote, it's going to unify the entire world. He explained that this throne is a monumental hope for the world. The truth can galvanize your life and fill you with joy and hope as nothing else can, he said. The royal family has a long history with God, and God has a lot to say about it. He has a wonderful plan for a future throne too. And our new book, The New Throne of David, explains that plan and goes through a change that's gone on with that throne in great detail. It's a plan for everyone on Earth, not just those that are interested in the royal family. And you can read it for free online or download or order your own copy at our website, thetrumpet.com.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
A hit television show in Germany looks back at some telling German history, but it makes some historical associations that are even more telling, as we will now hear in this report from Josue Michels.
People in more than 35 countries are watching a hit German television series called Babylon Berlin. The show is filled with deception, crime, sex, and violence. What makes the phenomenon of this show's popularity interesting, however, is the real-life connection between Berlin and Babylon, past and future. This mature-rated historical crime drama is now entering its fourth season. Based on novels by German author Volker Kutscher, it takes place in 1929 in Germany's Weimar Republic. This was a time of great uncertainty in Germany and looming radical change. The producers described the period this way, quote, "Speculation and inflation are already tearing away at the foundations of the still young Weimar Republic. Growing poverty and unemployment stand in stark contrast to the excesses and indulgence of the city's nightlife and its overflowing creative energy." End of quote. In March 2018, the Washington Post characterized it as a classic with classic Weimar stereotypes. Flapper girls and Nazi stormtroopers, prostitutes and proletarians, chess troops and jackboots. The plot of the third season revolved around a young police officer who was transferred from Cologne to Berlin to solve a criminal case that involved a pornography ring run by the Berlin Mafia. The young man soon finds himself confronted with a tangled web of corruption, drug dealing, and weapons trafficking, forcing him into an existential conflict as he's torn between loyalties and uncovering the truth. But why the title Babylon Berlin? The Bible calls Babylon a whore because of the city's immorality. The filmmakers saw the Bible's description and historical account as a perfect description of Weimar Berlin. Cultural journalist Jens Balkenburg noted, quote, "This Berlin is a Moloch. Sin, corruption, and violence lurk around every corner, as in the myth surrounding the biblical city." End of quote. That Babylonian spirit in Berlin during this time period ranged from architecture, ornamentation, art, and even the naming of structures, such as the Kino Babylon Theater, which opened in 1929. Fittingly, on February 10th, 2016, the primary actors of Babylon Berlin were publicly presented in that theater. If you visit Berlin today, the city's connection to Babylon is on vivid display at the Pergamon Museum, which houses the famous Babylonian Ishtar Gate, which I was privileged to see just a few years ago. Through Babylon Berlin, Germans, wittingly or not, are reminded of their ancestors' history, but not just from the Weimar Republic. The people who settled in Central Europe and became known as the Germans had migrated in ancient times from the land of Assyria. Read our article on thetrumpet.com, The Remarkable Identity of the German People, for more information. The Assyrian Empire had adopted many practices from the Babylonian Empire. The fact that the Germans descended from the ancient Assyrians makes the Babylonian Berlin phenomenon all the more interesting. Babylon and Assyria were contemporary empires in ancient Mesopotamia, the region of modern Iraq. Both were successful in conquering other kingdoms, establishing trade and amassing wealth. With few natural borders and aggressive ambition, Assyrians were constantly at war. Will Durand wrote in Our Oriental Heritage, quote, "In such an atmosphere, the only science that flourished was that of war. Assyrian medicine was merely Babylonian medicine. Assyrian astronomy was merely Babylonian astrology. The stars were studied chiefly with view of divination." End of quote. Assyria's educational system was a largely Babylonish educational system. The Assyrian capital of Nineveh contained thousands of clay tablets from Babylon and Sumer. Around 1728 and 1686 BC, Assyria was conquered and became a vassal state of Babylon under King Hammurabi of Babylon. Babylon quickly rose to become the political and commercial center of the Tigris-Euphrates area. That changed when Shalmaneser I rose to power in Assyria and declared independence from Babylon and supremacy over Western Asia. His son conquered Babylon. During his reign, Assyrians learned about Babylonian politics and laws. Assyria and Babylon also share the same religious roots. In the second generation after the flood, a man named Nimrod organized people into cities such as Babylon and Nineveh, as the late theologian Herbert W. Armstrong explained in Mystery of the Ages. Nimrod became their god, and after his death, his wife Semiramis carried the religion forward and thus became the founder of much of the world's pagan religions, in contrast to the religion of the Bible. As Alexander Hyssop explained in The Two Babylons, much of the same religious system continues to exist in modern Europe today and in different forms around the world. Mr. Armstrong noted, quote, "Even such so-called Christian observances as Christmas, New Year's, and Easter emerge from the false religious system she developed," end of quote. Assyrians were some of the first to pick up the so-called Christianity that originated in Rome, because it was not much different from their own religion. It is therefore unsurprising that the celebration of the modern Easter feast that highlights the fertility of rabbits has a lot to do with the worship of Babylonian goddess of Ishtar, the goddess of fertility, and almost nothing with the biblical Passover. Request a free copy of Pagan Holidays or God's Holidays, which, to learn more about the pagan origin of many of today's holidays. Astoundingly, the Bible reveals in Revelation 17 that the Babylonian system would again be revived in modern Europe. Revelation 18:10 is a prophecy of the coming judgment of the Babylonian system that is yet to be fulfilled. Revelation 18:10 reads, "Standing afar off for the fear of her torment, saying, Alas, alas, that great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour is thy judgment come." This is not a prophecy for ancient Babylon, but for those who continue its tradition. In The Plain Truth, August 1959, Herbert W. Armstrong stated concerning the reference of Babylon in Revelation 18, quote, "Notice that this final union of 10 nations in Europe is called by the prophetic name Babylon. It is merely the continuation of the ancient Babylonic system, a union of politics and religion, and great economic cartels whose purpose is to rule the world." End of quote. Babylon Berlin highlights Germany's historic connection to Mystery Babylon the Great, the Mother of Harlots, and the Abomination of the Earth, as seen in Revelation 17, verse 5, and the prophesied revival of this political religious system. It also points to the many prophecies that speak of Babylon's coming destruction and how it will soon be replaced by God's true religion. To learn more about this fascinating history and these most hopeful prophecies, request a free copy of Mr. Armstrong's greatest work, Mystery of the Ages.
It's time for today's Last Word.
Many people don't want to take responsibility in their own life. They might want results, they might want credit, but it's better to avoid responsibility. That way you don't get blamed if things go wrong, and you don't have to do all the hard work. Some people have elevated avoiding responsibility to an art form. Today you have a multitude of options for shifting responsibility for your choices. You can blame your parents, your socioeconomic status, your schooling, your boss, your friends, big banks, corporate greed, racism, special interest groups, self-serving politicians, whatever suits you. This is the dominant attitude in a world ruled by Satan the devil. And why is that? It's because he has never accepted responsibility for his own failures. He blames everything on God himself. Take responsibility. Stop making excuses. Accept the fact that your life is your responsibility. What happens if you go through life focusing on what you don't have, if you focus on what other people aren't doing for you, if you never take responsibility for yourself? Well, what happens is you never mature. You become stuck thinking like a child. In some form, you forfeit responsibility for your life to someone else. As a newborn, you needed someone else to do everything for you. And growing up means taking one responsibility on after another. Going to the bathroom yourself, dressing yourself, doing chores, going to school, finishing your homework, driving a car, getting a job, marrying, having kids. One of the major determinants of your maturity is how much you embrace responsibility. A responsible 16-year-old can be more mature than an irresponsible 40-year-old. This process is a journey that moves you from being taken care of to taking care of yourself and others. The Apostle Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 13, verse 11, "When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things." Well, the man who believes society owes him a comfortable living is still thinking like a child. The man who grouses about how unfair the world is, who says riches and privilege are just a matter of luck, he's still thinking like a child. The man whose failures are always someone else's fault is stuck in childish thinking. The man with no ambition, who's content to live off his parents' largesse or a government handout, kicking back and relaxing rather than applying himself and building character, this man still speaks and understands as a child. The man who's more focused on what the world should do for him than on what he can contribute to those around him, he's not yet thinking like a real man. The man who sinks significant time into worthless, selfish pursuits has not yet put away childish things. Maturing means that you grow from deflecting blame to accepting responsibility. You grow from being a passive observer to being an initiator. You grow from being a victim to being a doer, from expecting things to providing things, from following to leading. God created your brain and your mind, and with it, he's given you an amazing power, the power not only of thought, but of free choice. And he's also revealed in his word how to make right choices that lead to abundant life. And now he leaves the choice and its inherent responsibility up to you. Now, this is extraordinary. If God only wanted peace, he wouldn't have created human beings in the first place, or he would have programmed human minds to do the right thing every time. He could have made humans like nice pets. A pet is enjoyable to have around. It's always friendly. It doesn't keep you up at night trying to figure out how to help it make better choices in life. But God isn't interested in that. He wants a family. He wants sons who have voluntarily chosen to live the blessed, productive, exciting, and thrilling way of love that he himself lives. As a human being, you can't not choose. In the Bible, God reveals only two alternatives: obedience or disobedience. Obedience brings blessings, disobedience brings curses. There are only two alternatives, and you must choose. And because you're the one who chooses, you're the one who receives the consequences. Now, people always want to make excuses, but God exposes those excuses for what they are. They're just illusions. Men cannot avoid consequences for their decisions any more than they can avoid making decisions. So don't run away from this reality. God has given you an awesome power, the power to choose, the power to take responsibility, to mature into a better, more powerful, more fulfilled person. The power to steer your life towards success. Now, is God hard because he wants us to bear our own responsibility? No, he is a loving father who wants to help us to grow up into better, greater, more fulfilling, more meaningful lives. Shrugging off personal responsibility is not a luxury, it's a trap. If you insist that your problems are someone else's responsibility, then what can you do about that? Nothing. You just have to wait for someone else or some other force beyond your control to come along and pull you out. You waste your time languishing in dissatisfaction, waiting for that magic moment or that pandering politician, that figurative lottery ticket. As long as you blame other people, you are trapped. Of course, the actions of other people affect you. But don't deceive yourself. You are responsible for your own life, including its mediocrity and its failures. God says this in Ezekiel 18, "Yet say you, why does not the Son bear the iniquity of the Father? When the Son has done that which is lawful and right and has kept all my statutes and has done them, he shall surely live. The soul that sins, it shall die. The Son shall not bear the iniquity of the Father, neither shall the Father bear the iniquity of the Son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon him, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon him." That's very liberating when you think about it. You don't have to be a victim. Take responsibility for your own life, even if it's a mess. All men have problems they'd rather someone else deal with. The godly man takes charge of his own circumstances, including his problems, and he appeals to God for help, and he partners with God to change his own life. Realize this: you control the way people treat you and the way people respond to you by how you conduct yourself. You tell people how to treat you with your attitude, with your appearance, with your actions, how you talk, how you dress, whether you're respectful, your work ethic, how you keep your word, whether you give or take. Take responsibility for the reactions that come from your own choices. Don't blame other people for their reactions to what you are doing. Focus on being a respectable person, worthy of confidence, worthy of trust, and then let the world decide how they respond to you. God says the person who's responsible for you is you. Galatians 6, verses 4 and 5 say, "Let every man prove his own work, for every man shall bear his own burden." You have to carry your own load. In fact, God wants you to go beyond simply bearing your own burden. He wants you to reach out to help others carry theirs as well. So you certainly have to take responsibility for your own. Verses 7 and 8 there in Galatians 6 say, "Be not deceived, God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man sows, that shall he also reap. For he that sows to his flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption. But he that sows to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting." So if you don't like what you're reaping, then take a hard, honest look at what you've been sowing and start making some changes. God's way is radically pro-responsibility. And the sooner you learn that fact, the sooner you'll grow and mature and the more success you'll have. Think about the command in 2 Thessalonians 3 and verse 10. It says that if any would not work, neither should he eat. Now, that's God's way. Everyone who's able must work in order to eat. Now, in our modern world that is so intoxicated with government benefits and welfare, we've come to view a verse like 2 Thessalonians 3 and verse 10 as impossibly cruel. We think we've got a better way. Give the meal to the sluggard who chooses not to take responsibility. Who cares if it stunts his growth, his maturity, his productivity, his dignity, even his happiness? God says if a man doesn't provide for his family, his religion is worthless. You can read that in 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8. Now, is that cruel of God? No, he's just trying to teach that man to become useful and skillful. He's trying to build godly character in all of us. He wants to make you better and stronger and happier. Taking responsibility means the buck stops with you. It means you take ownership of whatever the job is that you're given to do, or whatever job you have. You cause something to happen. You do all you can to make it a success, and then you accept blame if it fails. That takes effort. It takes character. But it is a choice. You choose whether you can be relied on or not. If it's your priority, you'll take responsibility for yourself and you won't leave your needs and wants lying around to be picked up by others. You'll be dependable and trustworthy. You'll carry out your commitments to others. Now, if that's not your priority, then you'll be unreliable, unpredictable, distracted. You'll need reminders. You'll always show up late. You'll consume more time, attention, and resources than you produce. 1 Corinthians 4 and verse 2 says, a requirement for a steward is that he be faithful. And that word describes a man who proves himself worthy of trust, a man who can be relied on in transacting business or executing commands or discharging his duties. The motto of the U.S. Marine Corps is Semper Fidelis, always faithful. That's really a good motto for any of us, always faithful. God needs you to become reliable, trustworthy, responsible. Think about that with every responsibility you have, every job you're given. See it through, even when it gets tough. And as you do, you'll gain a reputation for responsibility, and God will be able to count on you. When God gives a job, He wants results. Our human nature wants to wriggle away from that. We want to put up excuses. Don't do that. If you're given a responsibility, take responsibility for that. When you make a mistake, take responsibility for that. You can't change something you don't admit. Until you own up to your own failures, you will remain stuck in those. Proverbs 28 verse 13 says, he that covers his sins shall not prosper, but whoso confesses and forsakes them shall have mercy. So you make a mistake, confess it, and then forsake it. Make a different choice the next time. What is your attitude toward responsibility? Do you embrace it? Do you want more of it? If you tend to be complacent and content with mediocrity, challenge that tendency. Think bigger, seek more. Stoke the fires of ambition within yourself. God wants you to take action. You only get the things you work for. There are no shortcuts to mastering a profitable skill or fortifying your work ethic or breaking a time-wasting habit or improving your diet. What are the things you've always wanted to do but have not acted on? Write them down. Bring them to God in prayer. Educate yourself in the steps to take. And then act. Do it. Get busy. Whatever the endeavor, take responsibility. Take action, even risk failure. If you don't try, you can't succeed. If you fail on the first effort, which you often will if you're trying anything that's really worthwhile, don't give up. Take more action, put in more work, power through it with God's help and with your effort. Sometimes windows of opportunity are open only for a moment. And if you're half asleep or you're entrapped in self-pity, you won't even recognize those moments. If you're habitually inactive or complacent, you'll allow timidity and fear to immobilize you. But if you're determined to take responsibility for your own life, then you will be alert to those opportunities. You'll face down your fear and you'll vault yourself through that window. Life rewards action, and taking action tends to season you and fortify you for taking more action. Accepting responsibility builds momentum toward greater responsibility. God wants to give you a lot of responsibility. He's watching to see what you'll do with what you have. And when He gives you resources or talents, He wants results. The individual who produces the most results is the one God knows can be trusted with more responsibility. Someday, you'll have to stand before God and give account. You can't stand before God and look around pointing your fingers of blame at other people. Those people have to answer for themselves, and you, face to face with God, will have to answer for you. Don't wait until then to start. God is measuring you right now. So take responsibility. And then God can help you grow and grow and grow. And God will give you far greater responsibility in the kingdom of God. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Mihailo Zekic, Richard Palmer, and Josue Michels. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Lionel Richie. Life begins at the edge of your comfort zone. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.